As Lee approached, he looked at the ground crew as they watched him. They were working quickly, without wanting to appear as though they were hurrying, as if to say they'd taken the money and would do the job, but this wasn't their fight. It was Lee's fight, however. One he'd been trained for, one from which he wouldn't run. Not when he had his quarry pinned in a plane that was suckling on a fuel tank, unable to go anywhere. When he was nearly at the nose of the plane, one of the two men re-emerged in the cabin door. He was holding a German Walter MPK submachine gun, and he wasted no time firing a burst at Lee. Having expected that, the FBI agent pushed off on his good leg and dove toward the opposite side of the plane, putting the nose of the aircraft between himself and the gunman. He wondered where airport security was. They had to have heard the gunfire, and he didn't want to believe that they were all on the take like the ground crew and that son-of-a-bitch Sawara. The shells picked a jagged line in the tarmac to his right, but they were several feet away from where Lee hit the ground. Crawling forward on his elbow, he stretched his arm out to shoot at the nose wheel. That would keep the plane on the ground long enough for someone to look into what was going on, unless everyone at the airfield, including the security forces, had been paid off. An instant before Lee fired, a burst erupted from behind him, chewing into his armpit and shoulder. He hadn't expected that. His arm jerked up, and he missed the tire, sending four shots into the wing and fuselage. Then another burst hit him in the right thigh. He turned and saw the bloodied form of Ken Sawara standing above him.
"You couldn't just leave it," Sawara gasped as he dropped to his knees. "You couldn't let me go."
Putting all his strength into his arm, Lee swung his .38 toward the soldier.
"You wanna go?" he said, sending a bullet into his forehead. "Go."
As Sawara dropped to his side, Lee turned his face toward the plane. He was struggling for air as he watched the men continue fueling the aircraft.
"This couldn't be it," he told himself.
"The crime fighter is betrayed by his partner and dies on an oil-slick tarmac. No one to see, no sirens in the distance, no one to book the criminals or lend him a hand, not even a conscience-stricken worker." Simon Lee died, feeling like he'd failed utterly. A half hour later, the plane took off, bound for Russia. Because of the darkness, no one on the ground or in the aircraft saw the thin stream of black smoke curling from the port engine as the Gulf Stream pushed skyward. Chapter 21. Monday, 12:30 a.m., Washington, D.C. Over lunch ordered from the commissary, Lowell Coffey, Martha McCall, and their aides worked in the attorney's wood-paneled office, picking through the legal minefield that was a part of every Stryker mission. Finland's president had approved a multinational Stryker landing to examine radiation readings in the Gulf, and Coffey's deputy, Andrea Stempel, was on the phone with the Interpol office in Helsinki, arranging to get a car and fake visas for three team members to enter Russia. Nearby, on a leather couch, Stempel's assistant, paralegal Jeffrey Dreyfus, went over the wills of the Stryker commandos. If the paperwork was not in order, reflecting up-to-date changes in marital status, children, and assets, documents would be faxed to the aircraft for signing and witnessing en route. Coffey and McCall themselves were looking at a computer monitor on the desk, drafting the finding, the lengthy final draft document that Coffey would need to present to the joint 8-person Senate and Congressional Intelligence Committee before Stryker landed. They had already negotiated the kinds of weapons that could be used, exactly what type of operation would be run, the duration, and other constraints. Coffey had been involved with some findings that had gone so far as to specify which radio frequencies could be used and what time, to the minute, the team would exit and enter. After all was said and much was done, approval from the committee to enter Russia did not actually give them the right to do so under international law. But without it, if captured, the Stryker team would be disavowed without approval and left to twist in the wind. With it, the U.S. would work quietly through diplomatic channels to arrange for their release. Down the hall, past the offices of Mike Rogers and Ann Ferris, was Bob Herbert's tidy command center. The narrow rectangular room consisted of several banks of computers, on a small table with detailed world maps on three walls, and a dozen television monitors on the far wall. Most of the time the screens were dark. Now, however, five of them were aglow with satellite images of Russia, Ukraine, and Poland. Old pictures morphed into new ones every 0.89 seconds. There was a long-standing debate in intelligence circles about the value of ELINT-SIGINT spies in space, as opposed to reliable data gathered from HUMINT personnel on the ground. Ideally, agencies wanted both. They wanted the ability to read the odometer on a jeep from a satellite 50 miles in space, and ears on the ground to report on conversations or meetings held behind closed doors. Satellite spying was clean. There was no chance of getting captured or interrogated, no risk of double agents feeding false information. But it also didn't have the capacity of an intelligence officer on the ground to distinguish between real and false targets. Satellite surveillance for the Pentagon, the CIA, the FBI, and Ops Center was managed by the highly secretive National Reconnaissance Office in the Pentagon. Run by the meticulous Stephen Veens, a college buddy of Matt Stoll, it consisted of banks of television monitors set in 10 rows of 10. All of them watched different sectors of the Earth, each generating an image every 0.89 seconds, providing a total of 67 live black-and-white images a minute at various levels of magnification. The NRO was also responsible for testing the new AIM satellite, first in a series of orbiting audio imaging monitors designed to provide detailed pictures of submarine and aircraft interiors by reading the sounds and echoes of sounds produced by people and instruments therein. Three of the NRO's satellites were watching troop movements on the border of Russia and Ukraine, while two kept an eye on forces in Poland. Through a source at the United Nations, Bob Herbert had heard that the Poles were getting antsy with the Russian buildup. Though Warsaw had not yet authorized the mobilization of troops, leaves had been canceled and the activities of Ukrainians living and working in Poland near the border were being monitored by Warsaw. Veens agreed with Herbert that Poland deserved watching and had the photos sent directly to his office where OpsCenter's surveillance analysis team was studying them as they appeared. The printout of the day's activities of the soldiers in Belgorod indicated nothing unusual to Bob Herbert and his team of analysts. For nearly 2 days, the routine had been the same. Time, 0550, activity, first call. 0600, reveille formation. 0610 to 0710, physical training. 0710 to 0715, make beds. 0715 to 0720, inspection. 0720 to 0740, orders of the day given. 0740 to 0745, wash. 0745 to 0815, breakfast. 0815 to 0830, cleanup. 0830 to 0900, preparation for duty. 0900 to 1450, training. 1450 to 1500, prepare for lunch. 1500 to 1530, lunch. 1530 to 1540, tea. 1540 to 1610, personal time. 1610 to 1650, care and cleaning of weapons and equipment. 1650 to 1840, cleaning camp and general sanitation. 1840 to 1920, secure perimeter. 1920 to 1930, wash hands. 1930 to 2000, dinner. 2000 to 2030, watch TV news. 2030 to 2130, personal time. 2130 to 2145, evening formation. 2145 to 2155, evening inspection. 2200, retreat. While Herbert and his people stayed on top of the military developments, they also tried to collect information for Charlie Squires and his Stryker commandos about the situation at the Hermitage. Satellite reconnaissance turned up no unusual traffic, and Matt Stoll and his technical staff weren't having much luck working up programs to enable the AIM satellite to filter out the noise in the museum itself. The lack of personnel on the ground compounded their frustration. Egypt, Japan, and Colombia had agents in Moscow, but none in St. Petersburg. And in any case, Herbert didn't want to tell them that something was brewing at the Hermitage, lest they side with Russia. Old loyalties weren't necessarily changing in the post-Cold War world, but new ones were constantly being forged. Herbert didn't intend to help any of those along, even if it meant allowing extra time so Stryker could study the site firsthand before defining their mission. Then, at 10 minutes after noon, 8 p.m. in Moscow, the situation changed. Bob Herbert was called to OpsCenter's radio room in the northwest corner of the basement. Wheeling over, he headed toward Radio Reconnaissance Director John Quirk, a taciturn giant of a man with a beatific face, a soft voice, and the patience of a monk. Quirk was seated by Radio Computer Unit, Uther, Universal Translation and Heuristic Enharmonic Reporter, which was capable of producing a virtually simultaneous written translation of everything that was being said by over 500 different voice types in over 200 languages and dialects. Quirk removed his headset as Herbert arrived. The other three people in the room continued working at their monitors, which were trained on Moscow and St. Petersburg.
"Bob," Quirk said, "we've intercepted transmissions indicating that equipment is being collected at air bases from Ryazanye to Vladivostok for shipment to Belgorod."
"Belgorod," Herbert said. "That's where the Russians have been holding maneuvers. What kind of equipment are they sending over?" Quirk turned his blue eyes toward the screen.
"You name it. Automated communications trucks, vehicle-mounted radio relay stations, a helicopter-mounted retransmission station, petroleum, oil, and lubricants trucks and trailers, along with full maintenance companies and field kitchen trucks."
"They're setting up a communications and supply route," Herbert said. "Could be a drill of some kind."
"I've never seen one this sudden."
"What do you mean?" Herbert asked.
"Well," Quirk said, "this is clearly an engagement build-up, but before the Russians engage, there's always a great deal of communication about the expected time of the encounter and the anticipated size of enemy forces. We'll pick up their calculations on speed of movement scales, and there'll be conversations between frontline forces and headquarters about tactics, envelopment, turning movement, combined, that sort of thing."
"But you didn't get any of that," Herbert said.
"Zero.
This is as sudden as anything I've ever seen." "Yet when everything's in place," Herbert said, "they'll be ready for something big, like a move into the Ukraine."
"Correct."
"Yet the Ukrainians are doing nothing," Herbert said.
"They may not know anything's up," Quirk said.
"Or they may not be taking it seriously," Herbert said. "NRO photos show that they've got reconnaissance personnel close to the border, but not deep reconnaissance companies. Obviously, they don't expect to have to operate from behind enemy lines." Herbert drummed his leather armrests. "How soon before the Russians are ready to move?"
"They'll be in position by tonight," Quirk said. "By aircraft, it's just a short hop to Belgorod."
"And there's no chance that these are bogies?" Herbert asked. Quirk shook his head.
"These communications are real, all right. The Russians use a combination of Latin and Cyrillic characters when they want to confuse us. The letters shared by the alphabets are supposed to throw us off because it's tough to know which alphabet they mean."
He patted the computer.
"But Uther manages to sniff them out."
Herbert squeezed Quirk's shoulder. "Good work. Let me know if you pick up anything else." Chapter 22. Monday, 9:30 p.m., St. Petersburg.
"Sir," said red-cheeked Yuri Maryev, "the radio room says they've received a coded communication via Pacific Fleet headquarters in Vladivostok. It's from the plane you've had me follow on the Hawk satellite."
General Orlov stopped his slow pacing behind the computer bank and walked to the young man, who was seated at the far left of the bank.
"Are you certain?" Orlov asked.
"There's no doubt, sir. It's the Gulf Stream."
Orlov glanced at the clock on the computer screen. The plane wasn't due to land for another half hour, and he knew that region well. If anything, at this time of year, the winds would work against them and the plane would be late.
"Tell Zilash I'm coming," Orlov said, walking quickly to the door that opened into the corridor.
He entered that day's code on the keypad beside a door across the hall, then went into the cramped, smoke-filled radio room, which was located next to Glinka's security operations center. Arkady Zilash and his two assistants were sitting in a tiny room filled to the ceiling with radio equipment. Orlov couldn't even open the door completely, since one of the assistants was using a unit tucked behind it. The men were all wearing headsets, and Zilash didn't see Orlov until the general tapped him on the left earphone. Startled, the gaunt radio chief removed his headset and stuck his cigarette in an ashtray.
"I'm sorry, sir," Zilash said in his low, raspy voice.
As if suddenly realizing he should stand, Zilash began to rise. Orlov motioned with his fingers for him to sit back down. Without meaning to, Zilash had always managed to test the boundaries of military protocol. But he was a radio genius, and, more important, a trusted aide from Orlov's Cosmodrome days. The general wished he had more men like Zilash on his staff.
"It's all right," Orlov said.
"Thank you, sir."
"What did the Gulfstream have to say?"
Zilash turned on a digital audio tape recorder.
"I've unscrambled it and cleaned it up a bit," he said. "The transmission had a great deal of static. The weather is terrible over the sea right now."
The voice on the tape was faint but clear.
"Vladivostok, we have lost power in our port engine. We do not know how serious the damage is, but some electrical systems are out. We expect to land a half hour late, but can go no further. We'll await instructions."
Zilash's big hound-dog eyes peered up through the smoke.
"Any reply, sir?"
Orlov thought for a moment.
"Not yet."
"Get me Rear Admiral Pasenko at Pacific Fleet Headquarters." Zilash glanced at his computer clock.
"It's 4 in the morning there, sir."
"I know," Orlov said patiently.
"Just do it." "Yes, sir,"
Zilash said as he typed the name into his computer keyboard, accessed and input the scramble code, then radioed the base. When the Rear Admiral came on, Zilash handed the headset to Orlov.
"Sergei Orlov," said Pasenko. "Cosmonaut, fighter pilot, and reclusive homebody. One of the few men I would get out of bed to talk to."
"I'm sorry about the hour, Ilya," Orlov said. "How have you been?"
"I've been well," said Pasenko. "Where have you been hiding these past 2 years? I haven't seen you since the All-Service Senior Officer's Retreat in Odessa."
"I've been well."
"Of course," Pasenko said. "You cosmonauts exude well-being. And Masha, how is your long-suffering wife?"
"Also well," Orlov said. "Perhaps we can catch up later. I have a favor to ask, Ilya."
"Anything," said Pasenko. "The man who kept Brezhnev waiting to sign my daughter's autograph book has my undying friendship."
"Thanks," Orlov said as he thought back to how irate the leader of the Soviet Union had been. But children are the future, the dreamers, and there was never any hesitation on Orlov's part. "Ilya, there's a crippled aircraft that will be landing at the airport in Vladivostok."
"The Gulfstream. I see it here on the computer."
"That's right," said Orlov. "I've got to get the cargo to Moscow. Can you give me a plane?"
"I may have spoken too soon," Pasenko said. "Every plane I can spare is being used to transport materiel to the West."
Orlov was caught off guard. What can be happening in the West?
"I'd be happy to piggyback your shipment in my aircraft," Pasenko continued. "Space permitting, but I don't know when that will be. Part of the rush is we're expecting several days of severe weather from the Bering Sea. Anything still on the ground tonight is expected to remain there for at least 96 hours.
"Then there isn't even time to send a plane from Moscow," Orlov said.
"Probably not," Pasenko said. "What is so urgent?"
"I don't know myself," Orlov said. "Kremlin business."
"I understand," Pasenko said. "You know, rather than have your goods sit here, Sergei, I can help arrange for a train. You can run your shipment north from Vladivostok and meet it when the weather clears."
"The Trans-Siberian Railroad," Orlov said. "How many cars can you get me?"
"Enough to carry whatever is in your little jet," Pasenko said. "The only thing I couldn't give you is my personnel to man it. That would have to be approved by Admiral Varchik, and he's in the Kremlin meeting with the new president. If it isn't a matter of national security, he can get thorny about interruptions."
"That's all right," Orlov said. "If you can get me the train, I can get a crew to run her. Will you let me know as soon as possible?"
"Stay where you are," Pasenko said. "I'll radio back within the half hour."
Signing off, Orlov handed the headset to Zilash. "Radio the military base at Sakhalin Island," he said. "Tell the operator I'd like to speak to a member of the Spetsnaz detachment. I'll stay on the line."
"Yes, sir. Which member, General?"
"Junior Lieutenant Nikita Orlov," he said. "My son." Chapter 23, Monday, 1:45 p.m., Washington, D.C. Paul Hood and Mike Rogers were sitting behind Hood's desk studying the psychological profiles which Liz Gordon had just sent over. If there was any strain between the men over what had happened in the tank, it had been put aside. Rogers had a strong independent streak, but he was also a 20-year man. He knew how to take orders, including the ones he didn't like. For his part, Hood rarely overruled his deputy, and almost never in military matters. When he did, it was with the backing of most of his senior staff. The Peggy James call had been a tough one, but the bottom line was simple. The intelligence community was small, much too small, for grudges. The risk of sending a seasoned agent with Stryker was acceptable compared to the risk of alienating DI-6 and Commander Hubbard. Hood was careful not to be too solicitous with Rogers after their little showdown. The general would have resented that. But Hood made himself more open to Rogers' ideas, especially his enthusiasm for Liz Gordon's psychological profiles. Op Center's director put as much validity in psychoanalysis as he did in astrology and phrenology. Childhood dreams about his mother were as useful to understanding his adult mind as the gravitational pull of Saturn and bumps on his head were to predicting the future. But Mike Rogers believed, and if nothing else, it was useful to review the personal histories of their potential adversaries. The concise biography of the new Russian president was on the screen, along with access to file photographs, newspaper clips, and video footage. Hood scanned through details of Zhanyin's birth in Mahakhala on the Caspian Sea, his education in Moscow and rise from the Politburo to an attaché in the Soviet embassy in London, and then as deputy ambassador in Washington. Hood stopped scrolling when he reached Liz's profile. "He sees himself as a potential modern-day Peter the Great," Hood read Liz's summary, "who favors open trade with the West and a cultural influx from the U.S. to make sure his people continue to want what we have to sell." Rogers said, "That makes sense. If they want American movies, they'll have to buy Russian VCRs. If they want enough Chicago Bulls jackets or Janet Jackson t-shirts, companies will begin to open factories in Russia." But Liz says here, "I don't think he has the same aesthetic sense as Peter the Great." "No," Rogers agreed. "The Tsar was genuinely interested in Western culture. Zhanyin is interested in building the economy and remaining in power. The question, which we also discussed with the president last night, is how sure are we of his devotion to this course of action as opposed to militarism?" "He has no military background whatsoever," Hood said, looking back over the biography. "Right," said Rogers. "And historically, that kind of leader is quick to try and use force to get his way. Anyone who's been in a combat zone knows firsthand the price you pay there. As a rule, they're the most reluctant to use force." Hood continued reading. "Given the military warning General Rogers heard at the White House meeting last night," Liz wrote, "I do not believe that Zhanyin would pick a fight somewhere to prove himself or to appease the military. He prides himself on rhetoric and ideas, not on force or the use of arms. In these early days of his new government, his overriding concern will be not to alienate the West." Hood sat back, shut his eyes, and pinched the bridge of his nose. "You want some coffee?" Rogers asked as he continued to scan the report. "No, thanks. I swam in the stuff on the flight back." "Why didn't you try and sleep?" Hood laughed. "Because I got the last seat in coach, stuffed between the loudest snoring humans on Earth, both of whom took off their shoes and passed right out. I can't watch those cropped and edited movies on airplanes, so I just sat there and wrote a 30-page letter of apology to my family." "Was Sharon mad or disappointed?" Rogers asked.
"Both, and more," said Hood. He sat back up.
"Now let's get back to the Russians. I've got a better chance of understanding them, I think." Rogers gave him a light swat on the back as they looked at the screen. "Liz says here that Zhanyin isn't an impulsive man," Hood said. "He always sticks to his plans, guided by what he feels is moral or right, whether or not it's at odds with prevailing wisdom. See extracts Z-17A and Z-27C from Pravda." Hood brought up the cited newspaper clippings and saw how in 1986, Zhanyin strongly backed the plan of Deputy Interior Minister Abalia to crack down on mobsters who were abducting foreign businessmen in Georgia, even after Abalia was assassinated, and how he earned the enmity of hardliners by refusing to support a law in 1987 that would have banned the use of Lenin lookalikes for what were referred to as evenings of mockery. "A man of integrity," Hood read Liz's closing comments, "who has been shown to err on the side of risk-taking rather than caution." Rogers said, "Part of me wonders if that risk-taking would include a military adventure." "Part of me wonders that, too," Hood admitted. "He didn't hesitate to recommend using the militia against gangsters in Georgia." "True," Rogers said, "though you can argue that that isn't the same thing."
"How so?"
"Using force to maintain the peace is different from using force to assert one's will," Rogers said. "There's a point of legality there that, psychologically, would make a big difference to someone like Zhanyin."
"Well," Hood said, "this pretty well agrees with what you decided in the Oval Office last night. Zhanyin's not the problem. Let's see who else might be, then."
Hood went to the next section of Liz's report. She had playfully titled it Loose Cannons. He began scrolling through the names.
"General Victor Mavic," he read, "Marshal of Artillery in the Army."
"He was one of the officers who planned the attack on the Estonkino Television Center in 1993, Rogers said. "Defied Yeltsin and still survived. He's still got powerful friends in and out of government."
"But he doesn't like acting alone," Hood read. "Then there's our friend General Mikhail Kosygin, whom she describes here rather colorfully as a real nutburger. He was chief marshal of artillery and openly defended a pair of officers who had been rebuked and reprimanded by Gorbachev for ordering suicide missions in Afghanistan. Gorbachev gave him the ultimate punishment short of a court-martial," Rogers read, "a demotion after which he went to Afghanistan and personally commanded repeats of those same missions. This time, however, they turned out differently. He threw men-at-arms at the rebel hideout until it was taken."
"He definitely sounds like someone to watch," Hood said as he inched the text ahead. The next name on the screen was the most recent addition. "Interior Minister Nikolai Dogin," Hood said, then read, "This man never met a capitalist he didn't despise. If you look at picture Z/D1, you'll see that the CIA photographed him secretly visiting Beijing when Gorbachev came to power. Dogin was mayor of Moscow at the time, and he was secretly trying to rally the support of international communists against the new president."
"There's something about you former mayors that worries me," Rogers said as Hood accessed the photograph. His deadpan remark drew a smile from Hood. The men leaned close to the monitor and read the eyes-only notation on the photograph. It indicated that the picture had been turned over to Gorbachev by the U.S. ambassador. Rogers sat back.
"Dogin must have had a hell of a lot of support to stay in power after Gorby found out about that."
"Absolutely," said Hood. "The kind of support you nurture over the years and build into a network. The kind of support that lets you slip a government right out from under a duly elected president."
The intercom outside the door beeped.
"Chief, it's Bob Herbert."
Hood pressed a button on the side of his desk, and the lock clicked open. The door swung in, and an agitated Bob Herbert wheeled over. He dropped a diskette on the desk. Whenever Herbert was upset or puzzled, his Mississippi accent thickened. It was very thick now.
"Something's happened at 8 p.m. local time," Herbert said. "Something big."
Hood glanced down at Herbert's diskette. "What happened?"
"All of a sudden, Russians are every goddamn where." He pointed at the disk. "Run it. Gwan."
Hood downloaded the data and saw that Herbert wasn't exaggerating. Pilots and planes from Orenburg were being transferred to the Ukrainian border, the Baltic fleet was on a low-level alert, ostensibly as a drill, and the battery of 4 Hawk satellites, usually used to monitor the West, had been diverted to potential Russian targets in Poland.
"Moscow's paying special attention to Kiev and Warsaw," Rogers said as he studied the satellite coordinates.
Herbert said, "What's interesting about the Hawks is that the downlink station in Baikonur went silent at 8 p.m. local time."
"Just the station?" Rogers asked. "Not the satellite dishes?"
"Not the dishes," Herbert said.
"Then where's the data going?" Hood asked.
Herbert said,
"We're not sure. Though here's where it gets real curious. We detected increased electrical activity in St. Petersburg at exactly 8 p.m. local time. Now, that happens to have been when the TV station in the Hermitage began broadcasting, so it could have been coincidental."
"But you wouldn't bet the Ponderosa on it," Hood said. Herbert shook his head.
"This is what Evald Ekdal promised us," Rogers said, still studying the deployment. "Something military, and it's being done very cleverly. If you take each of these events individually, they're all pretty routine, except for the change in the Hawk targets. Materiel is moved from the port at Vladivostok on a regular basis. Maneuvers are held on the Ukrainian border twice a year, and it's time for that now. The Baltic fleet frequently drills close to shore, so that isn't unexpected."
"What you're saying," Hood said, "is that unless somebody had the big picture, it would seem as though nothing were amiss."
"Right," Rogers said.
"But what I don't understand," said Hood, "is if Zhanyin isn't behind whatever's going on, how could an operation of this magnitude be kept from him? He'd have to be aware that something's going on."
"You know better than anyone that a leader's only as good as his intelligence," Rogers said. I also know that if you tell two people something in Washington, it's no longer a secret, Hood said. That's got to be true in the Kremlin as well.
It isn't, said Herbert. If only one person knows something over there, it's no longer a secret.
You're forgetting something, said Rogers.
Shovich.
A man like that can use threats and money to shut down the information pipeline pretty effectively. Besides, though he may not have the big picture, Zhanyin probably knows about some of what's going on. Dogin or Kosygin may have gone to him right after the election and convinced him to authorize a few of the maneuvers and troop transfers to keep the military happy and busy. Dogin would benefit from that as well, Herbert pointed out. If at some point any of this goes wrong, Zhanyin's autograph is on several of the orders. There's mud on everyone.
Hood nodded, then cleared the screen. So, Dogin's the probable architect, and St. Petersburg is his sandbox.
Yes, said Herbert, and Stryker's gone to play with him.
Hood continued to stare at the black screen.
The Interpol report is due at 3, he said. That's when you guys sit down with the Hermitage plans and updates and figure out how to get inside.
Right, said Rogers.
Herbert said, I've got the tactics and strategy team putting together plans for our getting our team across the Neva using an airdrop, power rafts, or a midget submarine. Dom Limbos is overseeing it. He's worked river crossings before. And Georgia Mosley in supplies knows what gear she may have to dig up in Helsinki.
Then you've ruled out the idea of Stryker going in as tourists? Hood asked.
Pretty much, said Herbert. The Russians are still watching tour groups and photographing suspicious individuals in hotels, on buses, and at the museum and other sites. Even if our people never go back, we don't want their photos on file.
Rogers looked at his watch.
Paul, I'm going to go sit in on the task session. I've told Squires he can expect a game plan before he lands at around 4 p.m. our time.
Hood nodded. Thanks for everything, Mike.
Sure,
Rogers said. As he rose, he looked at an antique globe paperweight on the desk.
They never change, he said.
Who? Asked Hood.
Tyrants, said Rogers. Russia may have been a riddle wrapped in a mystery inside an enigma to Winston Churchill, but what I see here is a story as old as history. A band of power-hungry individuals who think they know better than the electorate what's best for them.
Hood said, that's why we're here, to tell them they can't do this without a fight.
Rogers looked down at Hood.
Mr. Director,
he smiled,
I like your style. Me and General Gordon.
Rogers left with Bob Herbert, leaving Hood perplexed and feeling as though he'd bonded with his general, though if his life depended on it, he couldn't figure out how or why.
Chapter 24, Tuesday, 5:51 a.m., Sakhalin Island. Sakhalin Island, in the Sea of Ohotsk, is a rugged 600-mile-long stretch of fishing villages on the coasts and majestic pine forests and coal mines in the interior, of rutted roads and a few new highways, of ruins of Romanov prison camps and of ancient graves where the most common surname is Nepomnyoshchi, unremembered. Situated one time zone west of the international dateline, it is closer to the Golden Gate Bridge than it is to the Kremlin. When it is noon in Moscow, it's already 8 p.m. on Sakhalin. The island has long been a retreat for leaders, many of whom have dakas, comfortable cottages in the hills, and for eremites, who lose themselves in Sakhalin's untouched wilderness to seek God and peace. The Russians have long maintained a military presence in Korsakov, on the island's southeastern tip, near the Kuril Islands, which stretch from the northern tip of Hokkaido to the southern tip of Kamchatka. The islands were occupied by the Soviet Union in 1945, though Japan still claims the 700-mile-long string of islands, and the nations have argued over them ever since. The Russian base in Korsakov is Spartan, consisting of an airstrip, a small harbor, and four barracks. 500 naval troops and two regiments of Spetsnaz frogmen and naval soldiers are stationed here, daily air and sea patrols keeping an eye and electronic ear on the activities of Japanese salmon boats.
23-year-old junior lieutenant Nikita Orlov sat at his desk in the command post, high in a peak overlooking the sea and the base. His black hair was close-cropped, save for the longish waves that hung down over his forehead, and his full ruddy lips were set in a square jaw. His brown eyes were alert and gleaming as he reviewed local intelligence and faxed news reports from the previous night, and stole frequent glances out the open window. The young officer loved getting up before dawn, learning what had happened while he slept, and then watching the sun peek over the horizon and burn across the sea toward the base. He loved the waking of the world, even though each day no longer held the promise it did when he was a boy and then a cadet, that the Soviet Union would stand as the most enduring empire in the history of the world. As keen as his disappointment was, Nikita loved his country as passionately as ever, and he loved Sakhalin. He had been sent here straight out of the Spetsnaz Academy, in large part to get him out of Moscow after the incident with the Greek Orthodox Church, but also, he had always felt, to keep him from sullying his father's good name. Sergei Orlov was a hero, valuable as a flight instructor to impressionable young pilots, useful as propaganda at international symposia and conventions. Nikita Orlov was a radical, a reactionary who yearned for the days before Afghanistan destroyed the morale of the world's greatest military, before Chernobyl damaged the nation's pride, before Glasnost and Perestroika caused the economy and then the Union to come apart. But that was the past. And here, at least, there was still a sense of purpose, still an enemy. Captain Leshev, perhaps suffering from a touch of cabin fever after 3 years in command of the Spetsnaz troops on Sakhalin, spent a great deal of time organizing shooting competitions, which were his passion. That left Orlov in charge of most military matters, and he felt that someday Russia would once again face Japan militarily, that they would try to establish a presence on the island, and he might have the honor of leading the shock troops against them. He also felt in his heart that Russia was not yet finished with the United States. The Soviets had beaten Japan in a war, and ownership of the islands was the prize. But there was a sense that Russia had lost a war with the United States, and the Russian spirit, certainly Orlov's spirit, bridled at that. Spetsnaz training had strengthened his belief that enemies must be destroyed, not accommodated, and that he and his soldiers should be unencumbered by any ethical, diplomatic, or moral considerations. He was convinced that Zhanin's efforts to turn Russia into a nation of consumers would fail just as Gorbachev's had, and that would lead to a final reckoning with the bankers and their puppets in Washington, London, and Berlin. Fresh tobacco had arrived the day before, and Orlov rolled a cigarette as the rim of the sun rose above the dark sea. He felt so much a part of this land, of each sunrise, that it seemed possible to touch the tobacco to the sun itself to light it. Instead, he used the lighter his father had given him when he entered the academy, the orange glow of the flame illuminating the inscription on the side. "To Nikki, with love and pride, your father." Nikita drew on the cigarette and slipped the lighter back into the vest pocket of his crisply pressed shirt. With love and pride. What would the inscription have read after he received his commission, he wondered. With shame and embarrassment? Or when Nikita requested this outpost upon graduation, away from his father and nearer a very real enemy of Moscow? With disappointment and confusion? The telephone rang, a relay from the communications shed at the foot of the hill. Orlov's aide had not yet arrived, so he picked up the trim black receiver himself.
"Sakhalin Post 1, Orlov speaking."
"Good morning," said the caller. Nikita was silent for several seconds. "Father?" "Yes, Nikki," said the general. "How are you?"
"I'm fine, though surprised," Nikita said, his expression suddenly alarmed. "Is it mother?"
"She's well," said the general. "We're both well."
"I'm glad," Nikita said flatly. "To hear from you after all these months, well, you can understand my concern."
There was another short silence. Nikita's eyes were no longer joyous as he watched the sun rise. They grew hard and bitter as he pulled a long drag from his cigarette, thought back to his increasingly tense conversations with his father, then further back to his arrest 4 years before. He remembered how ashamed and angry the general had been about what he had done to that church, how the famous cosmonaut who couldn't go anywhere without being recognized was embarrassed to go out. How finally, on the night Colonel Roski, not his influential father, had smoothed the matter over with the Academy and gotten Nikita reinstated with just a week of double turns on the extra duty post, his father had come to the Academy barracks and lectured him about the infamy of hate and how great nations and great citizens have been destroyed by it. The other cadets had been silent, and when the great man left, someone came up with the Nikita and Sergei game, which the soldiers in training played for days. Sergei had to guess where in Moscow his son was painting hate slogans, while Nikita gave him hot-cold clues. Nikita could still hear their voices, their laughter. The U.S. Embassy? Cold. The Japan Airlines terminal at Sheremetyevo Airport? Very cold. The men's dressing room at the Kirov? Warmer. Nikki, said the elder Olaf, I've wanted to call, but I only seem to make you angry. I'd hoped that time would rid you of some of your bitterness. Has it rid you of your arrogance? Nikita asked. This celestial idiocy that what we ants do down here on the hill is petty or dirty or wrong? Going into space didn't teach me that a nation can be destroyed from within, as well as from without, Olaf said. Ambitious men taught me that. Still full of piety and naivete, said Nikita. And you're still brash and disrespectful, the general said evenly. So now you've called, Nikita said, and we've discovered that nothing has changed. I didn't call to argue. No? What then? Nikita asked. Are you trying to see how far the transmitter at your new television station can reach? Neither, Nikki. I'm calling because I need a good officer to lead his unit on a mission. Nikita sat up straight. Are you interested? The general asked. If it's for Russia and not for your conscience, I am. I called because you're the right officer for this job, the general said. That's all. Then I'm interested, Nikita said. Your orders will come through Captain Leshev within the hour. You'll be seconded to me for 3 days. You and your unit are to be in Vladivostok by 1100. We'll be there, he said, rising. Does this mean that you're back on active duty? You know everything that you need to know for now, the general replied. Very good, Nikita said, puffing quickly on his cigarette. And Nikki, take care of yourself. When this is over, perhaps you'll come to Moscow and we can try again. That's a thought, said Nikita. And perhaps I can invite my former comrades from the Academy. Seeing you just wouldn't be the same without them. Nikki, you wouldn't have heard me out in private. And you couldn't have cleared the Olaf name unless it was public, Nikita said. I did that so others might avoid making a similar mistake, the general said. At my expense, thank you, father. Nikita ground out a cigarette. You'll excuse me, but I must get ready if I'm to be on the mainland by 1100. Please give my regards to mother and to Colonel Roski. I will, the general said. Goodbye. Nikita hung up the phone, then took a moment to look at the half-risen sun. It annoyed him that so many others understood what his father did not, that the greatness of Russia was in its unity, not its diversity. That, as Colonel Roski had taught, the surgeon who cuts out diseased tissue does so to cure the body, not to hurt the patient. His father had been selected as a cosmonaut because, among other things, he was even-tempered, brave, charitable, and an ideal figure to present to schools and international journalists and young flyers who wanted to be heroes. But it remained for trench fighters such as himself to do the real work of the new Russia, the rebuilding, purging, and undoing the mistakes of the past decade. After informing the duty officer where he was going, Nikita grabbed his hat and left the outpost, feeling sad for his father, but curious what the general planned for his son. Chapter 25, Monday, 2:53 p.m., over the Atlantic, northwest of Madrid. The inside of the C-141B Starlifter wasn't designed for comfort. It was custom-designed to weigh as little as possible, to give the craft as much range as possible. The canvas-covered walls did nothing to buffer the mighty drone of the engines, and the bare ribs of the fuselage were dark under the bare bulbs. The troops sat on padded cushions on wooden benches. In turbulence, though the shoulder harnesses held the soldiers in place, it wasn't uncommon for the cushions to slide out from under them. Though the benches could accommodate only 90 troops in relative comfort, the Starlifter was able to hold up to 300 troops. With only 8 people in the cabin, and a pilot, co-pilot, and navigator on the flight deck, Lieutenant Colonel Squires felt as though he were flying first class. His long legs were stretched in front of him, he had 2 of the thin cushions beneath him, and 1 between his back and the hard metal, and best of all, the cabin wasn't stuffy. On those occasions when the prime members of Stryker traveled with backup troops from the other services, and the 5 German shepherds of the canine corps, the cabin tended to fill quickly with the heat of the huddled, perspiring warriors. After several hours in the air, Squires appreciated the comfort. He had spent the first hour with Sergeant Chick Gray and Private David George, taking inventory of the gear they might need for Helsinki, spent the next 2 hours with Private Sandra Devone, reviewing maps of Helsinki and St. Petersburg on his laptop, and then he slept for 4 hours. When Squires woke, George handed him a microwaved meal and a cup of black coffee. The rest of the team had eaten an hour before.
"I've got to talk to General Rogers about getting us better food," Squires said as he flipped open the hinged styrofoam lid of the tray and surveyed the turkey slices, mashed potatoes, string beans, and corn muffin.
"We've got missiles that can fly around trees and over mountains and slip down someone's chimney, but they're serving us the kind of crap you get on commercial airplanes. It's still better than the rations my dad says they served in Vietnam, sir," George said.
"Yeah, maybe," Squire said, but it wouldn't kill them to give us a decent coffee maker. Hell, I'd pay for it myself. Doesn't take up any extra space, and they're idiot-proof. Not even the army can screw that up.
You never tasted my coffee, sir, said Sandra, without looking up from her copy of Wuthering Heights. When I'm home, my mom and dad keep the percolator under tight security.
Squires cut a piece of turkey.
What kind of coffee do you use?
Sandra looked over. Her large brown eyes were perfectly framed by her round face, and her voice bore the lilting trace of a youth spent in her native Algeria.
"Kind, sir? I don't know. Whatever's on sale."
"That's your problem," said Squires. "My wife buys whole beans. We keep them in the freezer, then grind them that morning. Usually something festive, like southern pecan or chocolate raspberry."
"Chocolate raspberry coffee?" said Sandra.
"That's right. We use a drip coffee maker, not a pot that burns the coffee, and we take it off the heat and put it in a butler as soon as it's brewed. When we drink, we never use milk or sugar. Those are the great equalizers. They make all coffee taste the same."
"Sounds to me like a lot to do before roll call, sir," said Sandra.
Squires pointed his knife toward her book.
"You're reading Bronte. Why not something off the romance racks?"
"This is literature," she said. "The rest is paint by numbers."
"That's how I feel about coffee," Squire said as he speared more turkey with his plastic fork. "If it isn't the real thing, if it's touch football, why bother?"
Sandra said, "I can answer that in one word, sir. Caffeine. When I read Thomas Mann or James Joyce till 4 in the morning, I'd need something to get me to class by 9.
Squires nodded, then said, "I've got a better way."
"What's that?"
"Push-ups," he said. 100 of them right out of bed. Wakes you faster than caffeine. Besides, if you can make yourself do that first thing in the morning, the rest of the day'll seem like a piece of cake.
As they spoke, radio operator Ishihonda made his way from the rear of the fuselage. A veteran striker and judo black belt, born of a Hawaiian mother and Japanese father, the short, boyish Honda was handling communications during the recovery of Private Johnny Puckett, who was wounded in North Korea. Honda saluted and handed Squires the receiver of the secure TACSAT communications radio he carried in his backpack.
"Sir, General Rogers is calling."
"Thank you," Squires said, swallowing the mouthful of turkey and taking the line. "Colonel Squires here, General."
"Lieutenant Colonel," said Rogers, "it looks like your team will be going to the target, and not as tourists."
"Understood."
"You'll have the specifics before you land," Rogers said, "regarding point of departure, transportation, landing, and timing, though we won't be able to tell you much about exactly what it is you're looking for.
Everything we know will be in the report, including where the DI-6 agent investigating the site was murdered. The Russians also got one of his informants, and another's on the run.
Take no prisoners, Squires said.
Right. Now, I've got mixed feelings about this, but you'll also have a new teammate, a British agent with a pair that clang.
Do I know him? Squires asked.
It's a her, Rogers said, and no. But she's got the credentials. I'll have Bob Herbert send her file through along with the task data. In the meantime, get McCaskey an inventory of the wet gear you have on board. If there's anything else we think you'll need, he'll have it waiting in Helsinki. And Charlie?
Yes, sir.
Tell everyone good luck and Godspeed.
Roger, Squires said, then signed off.
Chapter 26, Monday, 11 p.m., St. Petersburg.
3, 2, 1, we're on. There were no cheers as Yuri Maryev spoke, no smiles as General Orlov, pacing slowly behind the arc of computers, acknowledged with a nod the functional status of the Russian Operations Center. The countdown had proceeded without a hitch, and while the long day was coming to an end for most of the workers, Orlov felt as though his day was just beginning. He had asked to see all the data that came in over the next hour, which he would review with the directors of satellite surveillance and weather, cellular and radio communication, on-site operations, cryptography and computer analysis, imaging and interception. These included the 4-to-midnight shift heads of each department, the prime team, which covered the heavy data flow when it was 8 in the morning to 4 in the afternoon in Washington, as well as the deputy directors, who worked the midnight-to-8 and 8-to-4 shifts. Roski would also be present, not only as Orlov's second-in-command, but as the liaison officer with the military. Roski was not only in charge of analyzing shared military intelligence and feeding it to other branches of the armed forces in government, but of commanding the Spetsnaz strike team that was at the center's disposal for special missions. Orlov looked over at Roski, who was standing behind Corporal Yevashin. The colonel's hands were clasped behind his back, clearly enjoying all the quiet activity. He reminded Orlov of Nikita, the first time he took him to see the boosters and spacecraft at Star City. The boy was so excited he didn't know where to look first. Orlov knew that would change very soon, though. As soon as the center was declared operational, Orlov walked over to Roski. The colonel took a moment before turning and saluting slowly.
Colonel Roski, Orlov said, I would like you to tell me exactly where my son is. Everything in code. No need to log the order.
Roski hesitated a moment, apparently having tried and failed to ascertain Orlov's motive.
Yes, sir, he said.
Roski told Yevashin to have the radio room contact the base at Sakhalin Island and ask Sergeant Nagovin for the information. All communications were in pencil code 253. Letters had to be erased before it could be decoded. In this case, every second letter of every word in the code was false, as was every fifth word, save for the third letter of each false word, which was the first letter of the word that followed. Yevashin had his answer in less than 2 minutes, and his computer quickly decoded it for him. His hands still locked behind his back, Roski leaned over the screen and read,
Junior Lieutenant Orlov and his unit of 9 Spetsnaz soldiers have arrived in Vladivostok and are awaiting further instructions.
Roski fired Orlov a look.
General, he said tensely, is this a maneuver of some kind?
No, Colonel, it isn't. Roski's jaw tightened and unclenched several times. Orlov waited several long seconds to make sure that Roski was smart enough not to be insubordinate, not to complain that he had been excluded from a military maneuver. Roski had to feel humiliated in front of the staff, but he remained silent.
Come to my office, Colonel, Orlov said, turning, and I'll brief you on the disposition of the Sakhalin Spetsnaz unit.
The general heard Roski's heels click smartly behind him. Once the door was closed behind them, Orlov sat at his desk and looked at Roski, who stood before it.
"You're aware of Minister Dugin's shipment on board a private aircraft?" Orlov asked.
"Yes, sir."
"There's a problem," Orlov said. "Engine trouble. It can't go on. Because of the severe weather and the shortage of aircraft, I've ordered the shipment to be transferred to a train, which Rear Admiral Pasenko has informed me is at our disposal."
A train from Vladivostok will take 4 or 5 days to reach Moscow, Roski said.
But that's not where it's going, Orlov said. My plan is simply to get the shipment out of Vladivostok to a place where an aircraft will be able to rendezvous with it.
I was thinking that we might be able to get a helicopter out of Bada Aerodrome to meet the train in Bira. That's only 600 miles from Vladivostok, and appears to be far enough to the west to remain clear of the path of the storm.
You've done a great deal of work on this already, sir, said Roski. Is there anything I can do?
As a matter of fact, there is, said Orlov. But first, Colonel, I'd like to know how you first heard about the shipment.
Roski said matter-of-factly,
From the minister.
He communicated with you directly?
Yes, sir, said Roski. I believe you were at home at the time, having dinner.
The general swiveled over to his keyboard and opened the log file.
I see.
But you logged a report for me to look at later.
No, sir, said Roski.
Why not, Colonel? Were you too busy?
Sir, said Roski. The minister did not want the matter to become part of center records.
The minister did not want it, Olaf snapped. Is it not a standing order that every duty assigned by a superior be logged?
Yes, sir.
And are you accustomed to taking civilian commands over military ones?
I am not, sir, Roski replied.
I can speak for the center, Olaf said. We're an autonomous base serving all branches of government and the military.
But what about you, Colonel?
Do you have a special loyalty to the Ministry of the Interior?
Roski took a moment longer to answer.
No, sir. I do not.
Good, said Orlov. Because if there's another incident like this, I'll have you reassigned. Is that understood?
Roski's rock-rigid chin moved up and down slowly.
It is, sir.
Orlov inhaled deeply and began scanning the day's log. He never thought that Roski would rebel openly, and his restraint was to be expected. But he'd pushed the colonel into a corner, and he was about to push a little more. Roski would have to do something.
Did the minister tell you anything else, Colonel, such as the contents of the shipment?
He did not, Roski said.
Would you withhold that information from me if Minister Dogin instructed you to do so?
Roski glared at his superior.
Not if the information is the business of this center, sir.
Olaf fell silent as he failed to find the log of his own conversation with Dogin. He looked back at 811, which is when he remembered making the entry. The space was blank.
Is something wrong, sir? Roski asked.
Olaf did a word search of the entire file, just to make sure he hadn't mislogged the entry. Outwardly calm, inwardly, he was agitated when Gulfstream did not turn up anywhere. The general regarded Roski. The colonel's expression was relaxed now, which in itself told him something. Roski had removed the order.
No, Orlov said, nothing is wrong. I misplaced a log order. I'll re-enter it when we're finished.
He sat back, saw a satisfied twist tug at the side of Roski's mouth.
I've spent enough time on this matter, and I trust my wishes are clear.
Quite, sir.
I want you to inform Minister Dogin of my intentions, and to take over the operation personally. My son respects you, and I'm sure you'll work as well together now as you did in the past.
Yes, sir, Roski said. He's a good officer. The telephone beeped, and Olaf dismissed the colonel as he picked up the receiver. Roski shut the door without a backward glance.
Yes, Olaf said. Sir, it's Zilash. Would you please come to the radio room?
What's wrong?
The dish is picking up densely coded communications, Zilash said. We've sent them over to cryptography, but we've started to wonder if something might be happening before we're able to translate the messages.
I'm on my way, Orlov said. He left without bothering to relog the Gulfstream entry, certain that it would only be erased again. And angry that a meeting designed to put Roski in his place merely underscored his growing concern that Dogin and the Spetsnaz planned to run the center with him as a figurehead.
Roski's words echoed in his mind. Not if the information is the business of this center, sir.
In the space of just a few hours, the death of an enemy agent and information about the Gulfstream had been kept from him. The center was one of the most powerful reconnaissance bases in the world. Orlov would not permit Roski and Dogin to turn it into their own private resource, though he would not do anything just yet. He had learned from his days in space that it was most important to keep his head cool when his seat was heating up to 5,000 degrees Fahrenheit, and the pair had not yet come close to raising the temperature that high. In any case, he still had a facility to run, and neither the colonel nor a megalomaniac was going to keep him from doing his job. Orlov sidled into the cramped radio room, which was even thicker with smoke than before. Zilash's narrow face was angled upward, his eyes staring at nothing in particular as he listened on his headset. He removed them after a moment and looked at Orlov.
"Sir," he said around his cigarette, "we've been following two series of coded communications, and we assume they're connected. The first is from Washington to an aircraft over the Atlantic, and the second is to Helsinki."
He took two quick puffs, then stubbed the cigarette in an ashtray.
"We had the satellite team take a look at the aircraft. It's unmarked, though they make it out to be a C-141B Starlifter."
"Big troop carrier," Olaf said thoughtfully. "A modified version of the C-141A. I know the plane well."
"I thought you might." Zilash smiled, then lit a fresh cigarette. "The Starlifter is on a course toward Helsinki. We listened to communications between the pilot and the tower. He'll be arriving around 11 p.m. local time."
Olaf looked at his watch. "That's less than an hour from now. Any idea who's on board?"
Zilash shook his head. "We tried to listen in on the cockpit with the Svetlana in the North Atlantic, but the captain says there's an electronic field in the plane."
"So it's definitely intelligence," Olaf said, though he wasn't surprised. He thought back to the British operative who had been spying on the Hermitage, and quietly damned Roski for his handling of the matter. The man should have been watched, not driven to suicide, if indeed he took his own life. "Brief the Ministry of Security in Moscow," Olaf said. "Tell them I need someone in Helsinki to meet the plane and watch to see if the Americans are planning to cross over."
"Yes, sir," said Zilash.
Olaf thanked him, then went to his office and summoned Roski and Security Director Glinka to talk about which plan to implement in case they had visitors. Chapter 27. Tuesday, 6:08 a.m., Vladivostok. Lenin once said of Vladivostok, "It's a long way away, but it's ours." Through two world wars, the port city located in the Muryayev Peninsula, on the Sea of Japan, was a major entry point for supplies and materiel from the United States and elsewhere. During the Cold War years, the military shut the city off from the world, yet Vladivostok prospered as the port and the Pacific Fleet grew, and both military and commercial shipbuilding brought workers and money into the city. Then, in 1986, Mikhail Gorbachev inaugurated the Vladivostok Initiative, which reopened the city and made it what he called a wide-open window on the east. Successive Russian leaders have worked hard to make the city an integral part of trade in the Pacific Rim, but with the new openness have come gangsters from Russia and from around the globe, attracted by hard currency and goods that come into the port both legally and illegally. The airport in Vladivostok is located nearly 19 miles to the north of the city. It's an hour ride from the field to the train terminal, which is situated in the heart of Vladivostok, just east of the heavily traveled Ulitsa Oktyabrya. Upon arriving at the airport with his team, Lieutenant Orlov was met by a courier from the Rear Admiral's office. The young messenger handed the officer sealed instructions to call Colonel Roski for his orders. As snow began to flutter from pale gray skies, Nikita ran to his unit, which was lined up by the bullet nose in front of the Mi-6, the largest helicopter in the world, capable of carrying 70 people up to 652 miles. The troops were dressed in camouflage whites, their hoods down, compact backpacks at their feet. Each man was armed with standard Spetsnaz issue, submachine gun and 400 rounds of ammunition, a knife, six hand grenades, and a P-6 silent pistol. Nikita himself carried an AKR with just 160 rounds of ammunition, the short-barreled submachine gun being standard among officers. Nikita ordered his radio operator to unpack the parabolic dish. Less than a minute later, he was on a secure uplink to Colonel Roski.
"Sir," Nikita said, "Lieutenant Orlov calling as ordered."
"Lieutenant," said Roski, "it's good to hear from you after so many years. I'm looking forward to working with you."
"Thank you, sir. I feel the same way."
"Excellent," Roski said. "What do you know about your mission, Orlov?"
"Nothing, sir."
"Very well. Do you see the Gulf Stream on the landing strip?"
Nikita turned to the west, into the flurries, and saw the jet sitting on the tarmac.
"Yes, sir."
"Markings?" "N26922A, Nikita said. Correct, said Rosky. I've asked Rear Admiral Pasenko to send a convoy. Is it there? I see four trucks waiting behind the jet. Excellent, said Rosky. You are to unload the cargo from the jet, put it on the trucks, and meet the train which is waiting at the station in the city. Only the engineer will remain on board. Once the cargo has been loaded, you will move the train north. Your tentative destination is Bira, though confirmation will come once you are underway. You are in command of the train, and you are to take whatever measures you deem necessary to see that the cargo reaches its destination. I understand, sir, and thank you, Nikita said. He did not ask what the cargo was, nor did it matter. He would treat it as carefully as if it were nuclear warheads, which it could well be. He had heard that the Primorsky region, of which the city was a part, had designs on becoming politically or economically independent from Russia. This could be a preemptive move by newly elected President Zhanin to disarm the area before that happened. "You will be in touch with me as you reach each station on the Trans-Siberian route," Rosky said. "But I repeat, Lieutenant, you are to take any and all measures to protect your cargo." "Understood, sir," Nikita said. Returning the telephone to the operator, the lieutenant ordered his men into action. Snatching up their gear, they ran across the field to the Gulf Stream, increasingly invisible in the thickening snows. Chapter 28, Monday, 11:09 p.m. Moscow. Andrei Volka had never felt so alone or frightened. In Afghanistan, even during the worst of it, there were fellow soldiers with whom to commiserate. When he was first approached by P to work for DI-6, he felt sick to his stomach at the thought of betraying his country. But he took consolation from the fact that his country had abandoned him after the war, and that he had new friends in Britain and here in Russia, even though he didn't know who they were. No one would benefit, he knew, if he was captured and began rattling off the names of other spies. It was enough to know that he belonged to something, and that knowledge had sustained him in the bitter years when he was forced to deal with the aftermath of a back that had been broken in a dive into a trench. But the tall, thick-waisted young man had none of that as he approached the terminal. He had been startled during dinner by a beep from the telephone Fields Hutton had given him. It was hidden inside a Walkman, an item so desirable in Russia that he had an excuse to keep it with him always. His nameless contact had informed him of the death of both Fields Hutton and another agent, and told him to try and make his way to St. Petersburg within the next 24 hours, where he was to await further instructions. As he'd hurriedly dressed, leaving only with the clothes he was wearing, the Walkman, and the U.S. and German currency Fields Hutton had given him for just such an emergency, Fokin no longer felt like he had Britain behind him. Getting to St. Petersburg was going to be lonely and difficult, and even now he wasn't sure he'd be able to make it. He didn't own an automobile, and flying from even one of the smaller airports like Bykova was risky. His name would already be at all the counters, and agents might ask for 2 pieces of identification, instead of the fake one with which he'd been provided. His only chance was to take the train to St. Petersburg. Fields Hutton had once told him that if he ever had to leave the city, not to head for the airports or railroad at once. He wasn't as fast as a fax machine. Enthusiasm among clerks tended to wane as lunch or late evening neared. So he'd walked the streets until now, moving as though he had an immediate destination, when he had none, mingling with the decreasing number of people heading home from work or from food lines, circuitously making his way from his apartment off Prospekt Vernadskaya, through side streets where black market goods were being hawked from car trunks, to the nearby metro station. From there he rode the crowded train to the Komsomolskaya metro stop, with its distinctive six-columned portico, ribbed dome, and majestic spire, in the city's northeast. He walked around for nearly an hour before strolling toward the St. Petersburg station, which services St. Petersburg, Tallinn, and all points in northern Russia. The 400-mile railroad that connected Moscow and St. Petersburg was designed by American engineer Lieutenant George Washington Whistler, the father of painter James McNeil Whistler, and constructed by peasants and prisoners who were flogged by railroad personnel and forced to work long hours under often unendurable conditions. Shortly thereafter, in 1851, the Nikolaevsky station was constructed. Now known as the St. Petersburg station, it was the oldest terminal in Moscow and one of 3 stations situated off busy Komsomolskaya Square. On the left side of the square was the Art Nouveau Yaroslavl station, built in 1904,
which is the final stop of the Trans-Siberian Railway.
To the right is the Kazanya Station, a Baroque collection of buildings completed in 1926 from which trains to the Urals, Western Siberia, and Central Asia departed.
The St. Petersburg Station stood beside the Komsomolskaya Pavilion, just northwest of the Yaroslavl Station. As Volka approached, he used his sleeve to dab perspiration from his high forehead and pushed his longish, dirty blonde hair from his head.
Calm, he thought. You have to act calm. He put a big smile on his large, friendly mouth, like a man going off to meet his lover, though he knew the smile wasn't reflected in his eyes. He only hoped no one looked closely enough to notice.
Volka turned his large, sad brown eyes up at the tall, lighted clock tower. It was just after 11. Trains departed 4 times a day, starting at 8 in the morning and ending at midnight, and Volka's plan was to purchase a ticket for the last train and watch to see if passengers were being stopped by the police. If so, he had 2 options. One was to engage another passenger in conversation as he headed toward the train, since the police would be watching for someone traveling alone. The other option was to boldly walk up to one of them and ask directions. Field Sutton had told him that operatives who skulk in a fast-moving environment only call attention to themselves, and that it was human nature to ignore people who seem to have nothing to hide. The lines at the ticket windows were long, even at this hour, and Volka stood in one in the center. He had bought a newspaper and looked at it as he waited without really assimilating anything he read. The line crept along, though Volka, usually an impatient man, did not mind. Every minute he was free gave him more confidence, and also meant that he would have to spend less time as a captive in the train before it departed. He purchased his ticket without incident, and though police officers were watching people who came and went and questioned a few men traveling alone, Volka was not stopped. "You're going to make it," he told himself.